Yes.
Thank you, Secretary.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Why are you so rude? Just wait. I'm calling on people.
Thank you, Secretary. Yesterday in the President's Truth Social, he threatened to wipe out a civilization.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to TruAnon. The boulder has been pushed aside. We are leaving the cave. And then, much like that famous story, it finishes quite quickly.
Leaving the cave has got to hit really different.
It's got to be amazing. Jesus coming back to the sunlight?
Ooh, it's dark in there.
Oh, wow, my eyes.
I don't want to be in the cave.
Is that my father's light? Well, I guess in a way it's my father's light, but no, it's just the regular sun. Hello, my name is Brace Belden.
I'm producer Young Chomsky.
And this is the TruAnon podcast. It is, right now, 3:46, Tuesday, April 7th. By the time this episode comes out, the United States has either destroyed every bridge and power plant in Iran, or that has not happened. Many people will die in pretty horrible ways if that does happen. It'll be exploded, burned, strangulated, or they will not. There is a deadline that is set to expire 4.5 hours from now. It's one of a number of deadlines that the U.S. has set. God knows. I mean, with this kind of stuff, it's one takes it seriously, but then it's just, I guess what I'm just going to say is you never know what's going to happen.
That's
you
true.
Know? The deadline's supposed to happen tonight. We can't record tomorrow. We got to record this now. But honestly, in a way, I don't think it really matters, because whatever I would tell you about that, you could probably figure out on your own. Mm-hmm. Deadline is nasty. It's a rotten thing. The things that Donald Trump is saying he's going to do, destroying the civilian infrastructure, obviously that is it's a war crime, which is like one of those things where it's like, all right, that doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, it's like, that's a war crime. Okay. You know, are you going to arrest Donald Trump?
Right.
I don't think that you are. The flow of information has been so great. The data points so vast and so varied that it has been like trying to wrangle little bubbles in a plastic bag. So instead of trying to do this and this story, oh, this is happening, this is happening, this is going to be the effects of that, this is going to be an episode of sort of anti-analysis. You know, we did that one when the Iran war first started, or this segment of the Iran war first started. Mm-hmm. That was, I guess, kind of the experience of looking at the news, and that this is somewhat like this. I was on another little trip. I was in Los Angeles and I was kind of going crazy. I think I might be burnt out. I mean, my fucking brain is fizzled, but you know, I try to follow the news, and I'm like, I'm sitting there on this flight yesterday, third time in a row, third flight in a row, gentleman next to me, TikTok.
Yeah.
No headphones.
I had a guy on the subway here, and right across from a guy who was very, you know, listening to something with headphones. And I wanted to come up to the first guy and say, see that guy? What do you think he's listening to?
The subway is one
thing. We
don't know. People are going to be rude on the subway, and I take that.
Yeah.
Because they're going to get off. They're going to go in a long stretch with no Wi-Fi. The TikTok's going
to
end.
For some reason, they don't seem to, though, which I don't understand.
I know,
how they manage.
TikTok has got some special thing.
They're cashing it.
Yes, I know.
Aggressively.
And then it goes the next four or five are loaded in there. But the plane.
Yeah.
It's getting difficult. And it smelled like fucking McDonald's, the whole plane. All these people buying their fucking McDonald's and then waiting. I wanted to eat this in the airport. I'm not going to eat this shit in the fucking airport. I'm going to eat it on the fucking plane. And I sit there and I'm just like, God, I'm trying to figure out an episode for today. I had a guest. These things happen. The guest is no longer with us. And I figure, okay, well, I'll just do this myself. And, it has been a journey, and so I hope this might be the worst episode we ever do, but we'll give it a shot. I want to start off with something from Middle East Eye, April 2nd.
Two people were killed and several more injured in a U.S.-Israeli strike on a bridge in Karaj, a city near Tehran. The highway bridge was targeted for a second time while rescue forces were at the scene to help people wounded in the previous strike, Iran's Fars news agency reports. Al-Bor's provincial officials have urged people to avoid the site.
I don't know if you've seen pictures of the aftermath of the bridge, but they basically blew up the exact middle of this bridge. There was some claims in the U.S. government, oh, it's used to transport materials that can be used in missile making.
Mm.
Well, of course, that applies to all civilian infrastructure of any kind. And really, if you extrapolate that out, it kind of applies to all, not only all infrastructure all over the world, maybe not in Bhutan.
Yeah. But I imagine missile making materials can be quite diverse. Just about anything could be used to make missiles.
Exactly. And so you just extrapolate this outwards and you say, oh, okay, I guess anything's fair game.
Right.
What I think is notable is the claims, which I believe, of the double tap. Mm-hmm. Because at first it was two killed. This is what they're reporting here, two killed. Now I believe it is up to eight killed and still 95 injured. Then let's go forward to Truth Social, Easter Sunday. Trump truths this.
Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah.
I don't know if you read the New York Times article that came out today.
I didn't catch it yet.
It was this long. It's an excerpt from that. What's that? Jonathan Swan. Remember they tried to give him a TV show?
Yes.
Didn't work out for him too well, did it?
Swan song.
Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman. Some excerpt from some new book they're writing. And God knows how true in every aspect all this is, but it seems basically believable. And it's exactly what we suspected. It is essentially an account of Benjamin Netanyahu's hard pitch to Donald Trump about overthrowing the Iranian government and some kind of combined regime change, mass disarmament program that they were going to go through. And it describes a, I believe, February 11th meeting. I don't have it in front of me, but February 11th meeting where Netanyahu goes in there. He's with the Mossad chief, and he sits across from Trump, and he's like, we're going to do this. And Trump is like, this sounds like an amazing idea. Trump takes this to his cabinet, to parts of his cabinet, including his son-in-law, who is sort of this a minister without portfolio, I guess, floating around in the cabinet, who is also, God, I mean, you know who fucking Jared Kushner is. I don't know why I'm explaining this to our audience. And he lays this out for them, and they're too cowardly or too stupid, or they're in agreement with him that this is this idea. Okay, maybe not all the points that he laid out will work, but we can at least do some of them. And Trump says, okay, sounds incredible to me. At no point during this article did I find any mention of anybody within this administration saying, oh, well, this and this benefit will occur for the American people. The only sort of even tangential mention of that is, God, I can't remember who, but I think it's some White House counsel saying, oh, well, you know, I used to be a Marine and the Iranians killed some Marines.
Yeah.
40 years ago.
Well, they're not, obviously way past the idea that, like, there's going to be a benefit to us. It's more just that this category of people is ontologically evil.
Yeah.
And therefore deserve to die. Nothing we do to them could be immoral. And, like, that's the thing that they're trying to convince people of.
Yeah, I know. But it's interesting because it's even the sort of the bloated Steve Chung, one of the oddest looking people to ever set foot in the White House.
Oddest jobs.
Yeah, he is. He really is. He's like, well, you know, whatever you choose is right, and we'll figure out a way to say this stuff. Guess what? It is now, what, April? February was 2 months ago?
Mm.
Doesn't seem like you guys have figured it out yet.
Yeah.
There is still no messaging from the White House that makes sense on this. Trump's speech that he announced, that they interrupted TV for the other day, was just another pathetic display of him rambling. And when I was watching Trump's speech the other day, I was like, God, is this how Aaron Rupar feels all the time? I mean, I'm just watching this fucking idiot standing and rambling. I mean, I cannot imagine. Obviously, I've been a conservative since the day I was born. I'm what they call a natural conservative. But I could not understand for the life of me why somebody is watching this and being like, well, you know what? I don't get it, but I support him. It was just stupendous to me. So he truthed that you read about the fucking, about to open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards. He truthed that on Easter.
I have a hard time imagining how that would sound coming out of his mouth too, which is why I kind of stumbled over it.
Like, yeah.
It's sort of in his vernacular, but just like, that's the open, the you crazy bastards part, it's bizarre.
Well, he's got that she slave who follows him around with a little fucking tablet at all times, and he dictates the truths to her. Yeah. So I've heard him say fucking before, and so I don't like it. I will say this, in writing in general, we got to put fucking. We got to put fucking. We're not doing the little apostrophe here. Mm. You're not, you know, it is just, other than that, it's too, it's, what is that? I don't know. It's too vernacular for me. I know that's not the word, but I don't like it. So one is reminded, all this shit, not of Jesus Christ, but in fact of the infamous Judas, who, and I'm going to have you read here from Acts, with his 30 pieces of silver,
purchased a field with the reward of iniquity, and falling headlong, he burst asunder in the midst, and all his bowels gushed out. And it was known unto all the dwellers at Jerusalem, insomuch as that field is called in their proper tongue, Aceldama, that is to say, the field of blood.
And you know what? I would say, God, that, it does remind me of Trump, and I do think that there is some kind of 30 pieces of silver he receives for this, even if it is a bit more ephemeral than that, you know, actually pretty high amount of money. People always say that, oh, Judas only sold him out for 30 pieces of silver. I don't know what inflation is, but I got to tell you, back in whatever, 33, probably kind of a lot of money, you know?
Yeah.
People act like it was a bad deal, but Judas...
It goes pretty far.
It goes pretty far back then. He bought a fucking field. Of course, he burst asunder there.
Yeah, that's one thing you don't want to burst.
But one bursts eventually anyways. And I thought of this with Trump, because God, could you imagine what he would look like if he could have just exploded like that?
So
moving on. This happened today. President Trump truthed this morning.
A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, but probably it will. However, now that we have complete and total regime change, where different, smarter, and less radicalized minds prevail, maybe something revolutionarily wonderful can happen. Who knows? We will find out tonight, one of the most important moments in the long and complex history of the world. 47 years of extortion, corruption, and death will finally end. God bless the great people of Iran.
I mean, what can you even say about this? Anybody who's listening to this show, I'm sure, has already encountered this phrase from the president sometime today, or I guess this comes out on Thursday, sometime within the intervening days. We'll just move on, you know? I mean, we'll just move on. There's nothing to, there's no analysis here. That's just what I read. Strait of Hormuz. I actually haven't written anything out about this, but I've been staring at it a lot, and it reminds me of a pelican with the beak, sort of a pelican after it's caught some fish. It is closed. I think traffic is down 95%. The Iranians have passed a bill saying that they'd like to start charging tolls on it. Trump has responded to that by saying maybe we'll start charging tolls on it. The U.S. hit Karg Island today. So far, no boots on the ground, but again, it is 3:58 on Tuesday. This is from NBC. This came out on April 2nd.
President Donald Trump on Wednesday said it's not possible for the federal government to fund Medicare, Medicaid, and child care costs, arguing that it should be up to the states to take care of those programs while the federal government focuses on military spending. It's not possible for us to take care of daycare, Medicare, Medicaid, all these individual things, Trump said. They can do it on a state basis. You can't do it on a federal. We have to take care of one thing, military protection. We have to guard the country.
This is from a report by Department of Health and Human Services that came out in 2025, I believe in March. The cost of raising a family in America is high and continues to rise, with inflation rising by 23% between 2020 and 2025. For working families, some of the largest non-discretionary expenses continue to be health care and child care. But even as spending rises, families are not getting healthier, and because of high costs, many are not able to choose the child care that best meets their needs as they strive towards financial self-sufficiency. These high costs are a disincentive for families to raise children and may be contributing to lower birth rates, which fell by over 20% since 2008. I can say from my own experience, talking to people that I know, the main reason that a lot of people I know don't have kids is because they don't know how they'll be able to afford it.
Yeah.
You know, they can barely afford rent in a fucking one-bedroom apartment, or God, maybe sharing an apartment with several other people. Let alone, I think it's the average for private childcare in New York City is $20,000 a year, which is just, I mean, obviously it's much higher here than most places. But even I think in the lower states, I was looking at this earlier, or the cheaper states in I think Mississippi, it's still $500 a month. And obviously the cost of living is much lower there, but also wages are significantly lower there. So God knows what that turns out to. However, we need money to bomb Iran. I was looking at the airlines.org jet fuel spot price chart, and I am looking at today. It is, excuse me, this is from yesterday, April 6th, $4.69 for a gallon of jet fuel. Go back to January 7th, it is $2.10. Times of Israel, April 6th.
The IDF acknowledges that an attempt to assassinate a Hezbollah operative near Beirut last night failed, and the strike killed a senior official in an anti-Hezbollah group. Lebanese media reported that the Israeli Navy strike in Ain Sadeh, east of Beirut, killed Pierre Mawad, a senior official in the Lebanese forces, a Christian political group that is opposed to Hezbollah, along with his wife. The IDF says the strike apparently failed to kill the Hezbollah target, and it regrets the harm to the civilians.
In 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon with the goal of expelling the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. The Israelis surrounded West Beirut and laid siege to it, with the aim of annihilating the PLO and related groups or expelling them. They worked in concert with allied local militias, including the so-called Lebanese forces. In late August and early September, the PLO was evacuated from Lebanon under an agreement brokered by Ronald Reagan's government. Many Palestinian refugees from the Nakba remained in Lebanon. In late September, the Lebanese forces rampaged through the Sabra neighborhood and the Palestinian refugee camp called Shatila, killing thousands of unarmed Palestinian and Lebanese Shia Muslims in what became known as the Sabra and Shatila massacres. Israeli forces had surrounded the area, and they are said to have sent in the Lebanese forces fighters to look for any remaining PLO forces. The Israelis lit the area at night with flares. This is from Jean Genet's essay, 4 Hours in Shatila.
A photograph has two dimensions. So does a television screen. From one wall of the street to the other, arched or curved, their feet pushing on one wall and their heads leaning against the other, the blackened and swollen corpses I had to step over were all Palestinian and Lebanese. For me, as for the remaining residents, moving through Shatila and Sabra was like a game of leapfrog. Sometimes a dead child blocked the streets, which were so narrow, almost paper thin, and the dead were so numerous. Their odor is no doubt familiar to old people. It didn't bother me. But there were flies everywhere. If I lifted up the handkerchief or Arab newspaper placed over a head, I disturbed them. Infuriated by my gesture, they swarmed over the back of my hand and tried to feed off of it. The first corpse I saw was that of a 50 or 60-year-old man. He would have had a ring of white hair if a wound, an axe blow, it seemed to me, had not split open his skull. Part of the blackened brain was on the ground next to the head. The entire body lay in a sea of black, clotted blood. His belt was unbuckled, and only one button of his pants was fastened. The feet and legs of the dead man were naked, black, purple, and blue. Perhaps he had been taken by surprise at night or at dawn. Was he running away? He was lying in a small alley immediately to the right of the camp entrance across from the Kuwaiti embassy. Was the Shatila massacre carried out in hushed tones or in complete silence? After all, the Israelis, both soldiers and officers, claimed to have heard nothing, suspected nothing, even though they had been occupying this building since Wednesday afternoon. Photography is unable to capture the flies or the thick, white smell of death, nor can it tell you about the little hops you have to make when walking from one corpse to the next.
This is from the New York Times from 1982. Mr. Begin has fostered the siege mentality, pulling into a tight defensive posture of righteous indignation. Goyim killed Goyim, and they immediately come to hang the Jews, he was quoted as telling the cabinet. And the cabinet endorsed his statement, issued as a communique that, quote, all the direct or implicit accusations that the Israeli Defense Forces bear any blame whatsoever for this human tragedy in the Shatila camp are entirely baseless and without any foundation. No one will preach to us ethics and respect for human life. To this, Maron Benvenisti, a former deputy mayor of Jerusalem, replied, that is the ultimate injury that the Germans inflicted on us. No one can tell us anything. On December 23rd, 2025, I read an article in Task and Purpose, the little military website, saying that they had discovered a physical loot box dispenser had been installed in the United States Pentagon. And that, in fact, there is a picture of a Charizard Pokemon card on the side of it. The boxes belong to a company called Lucky Box. And in fact, I have seen these boxes before.
Huh.
I believe they are in LaGuardia Airport, might be JFK, but they're in one of the New York airports. And I've always sort of hurried by them because I don't want to see the face of the poor sucker that is putting in $80, $100, or $200 into these things, because that is what they take. And you can get a graded Pokemon card, a signed jersey, or cryptocurrency.
Like a professional athlete jersey?
Yes, although I have read on Reddit that, in fact, it will not say the team's name on the jersey because they don't have a deal or something. God knows if this was just some Reddit thing, but it seems like very few people have actually used these boxes as there are vanishingly few reviews of them.
Huh.
Most people are saying it's a ripoff, and some people are saying, I got a rare Pokemon card. Lucky Box posts an Instagram post about it in a thread about it. And I'm looking at the Instagram post here, since deleted. And what do we have? It is a picture of the Pentagon, the logo, rather, of the Pentagon, a picture of the Lucky Box, and a Pokemon card for a Pikachu, a Harper jersey, and a some kind of sports card to set to the tune of Kato, Turn Off the Lights, Radio Edit. And it says, the ultimate collectibles mystery box experience. Lucky Box has officially arrived at the Pentagon. When this is reported on by Task and Purpose, Lucky Box takes down the posts, takes down the thread. Although, according to some things that I've read, the Lucky Box is still present at the Pentagon. From ABC News, Australia, April 6th. Actually, you know what? I'll read this one. A trucking company in Greater Western Sydney says it has almost lost $10,000 AUD. A trucking company in Greater Western Sydney says it has lost almost 10,000 AUD worth of diesel over the past months to thieves siphoning from truck tanks while drivers sleep. Have a little nappo. Scott Hanna, owner of Hanna's Haulage in Riverstone, said his trucks were first targeted about a month ago when fuel prices soared due to the war in the Middle East. If they have a 20-litre jerry can or a 40-litre or a 1,000-litre, they just take whatever they can get out of the trucks, he said.
I feel like you've been getting better at that.
I've been practicing.
I can tell.
And you know what they call gas stations there?
What do they call
them? They call them servos.
Servos.
And I said, okay, noted. And then I read this. Washington Post, April 2nd. The headline, wartime fuel shortages spawn panic, robberies, and killings in Asia.
Every day, attacks are reported across the roughly 3,000 fuel stations in the country. In northern Bangladesh, a group of motorcyclists beat a gas station worker so badly he was hospitalized. In a district east of the capital, Dhaka, motorists who were turned away without fuel returned after nightfall to haul station employees into a canal.
The article goes on to describe violence that can be fairly assessed as apocalyptic. Deranged motorists lurking in trucks outside of petrol stations so they can run over employees, mass beatings and thievery from big, you know, tanker trucks, roving bandits. I mean, it really is extraordinary. The article goes on to say this.
Bangladesh is already paying triple what it was a year ago to subsidize each cubic meter of liquefied natural gas, LNG, according to Shafiqul Alam, lead Bangladesh researcher at the U.S.-based Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. To maintain these subsidies, the government is seeking more than $2.5 billion in new financing from lenders like the World Bank.
This is from ABC Australia, March 17th. Sri Lanka's Commissioner General of Essential Services, Prabath Chandrakirti, said state institutions would operate only 4 days a week starting on Wednesday, local time. The article goes on to state, I don't have it written here, but the article goes on to state that they're encouraging private businesses to go down to a four-day week as well because of fuel rationing. This is from the Kiel Institute for World Economy Policy Brief on the closing of the Strait of Hormuz. Came out in March 2026. It's a paper.
Most critically for food security, the chemicals flowing through Hormuz are essential inputs to global food production, a vulnerability that standard analyses of choke point risk consistently overlook. Qatar and Iran are among the world's largest exporters of urea, the most widely used nitrogen fertilizer. The Gulf's cheap natural gas feeds the Haber-Bosch process that converts methane into ammonia and then into the granular fertilizer that sustains crop yields for billions of people. Iran is one of the world's largest methanol producers, and its mega plants supply downstream chemistry that feeds into formaldehyde for adhesives, acetic acid for food-grade products, and MTBE for gasoline. Qatar's Ras Laffan Industrial Complex, the world's largest integrated petrochemical site, produces ethylene, ethylene glycol, and a range of downstream products that flow into polyester fiber for clothing and PET resin for plastic bottles. When these plants shut down, the effects ripple from petrochemical feedstocks through fertilizer supply chains and into the cost of putting food on the table.
This is from Nikkei, April 7th. Thai fishing sector reluctant to sail as Iran war drives up fuel costs. Thailand's fishing fleet is shutting down as fuel costs sharply rise. Seafood prices remain flat due to weak consumer demand, and fishermen calculate that their catch will never cover costs. Some fear the war will do permanent damage to an important Thai industry. So far in Samut Sakhon, almost 50% of fishermen have already halted their operations. Mongkol Trilak, director of Samut Sakhon Fisheries Association, told Nikkei Asia, "I reckon for other provinces along the coast it is very similar. Since the start of the war, the catch has dwindled by about 30%. And who among us can forget the famous line in that famous pamphlet by Buchner? Peace to the huts and war to the palaces. And it's so funny because I think he wrote that in like the 1530 or some shit like that. And only a vanishingly few times in the intervening centuries has that ever happened. And it is certainly not happening now. One thing that is abundantly clear from this is while American consumers may feel a bit of a tightening price thing here or there, maybe gas will go up, we'll get to that. In the third world, this is affecting things greatly, and especially to places that are, to countries rather, in Asia, because Strait of Hormuz, just the way that products are moved around the world, greatly affects them. And also, a lot of these countries have a lot more fuel importation than countries in the West do. And again, this is not just about fuel. And I said I wouldn't do an analysis here, and so I'll refrain from that. But there are a lot of very vital pharmaceutical, plastic, and of course, agricultural products that flow through the strait as well. Not only flow through the strait, but are actually manufactured or whatever, refined in the Gulf and in Iran. And so with that in mind, here is a World Food Program press release from the 17th of March, 2026.
New analysis by WFP estimates that almost 45 million more people could fall into acute food insecurity or worse, known as IPC3+, if the conflict does not end by the middle of the year and if oil prices remain above USD 100 a barrel. These would add to the 318 million people around the world who are already food insecure. According to WFP's analysis, countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia are the most vulnerable due to a reliance on food and fuel imports. Projections indicate an increase of 21% in food insecure people for West and Central Africa and 17% for East and Southern Africa. An increase of 24% is forecast for Asia.
Those are extraordinary forecasts. 21% for West and Central Africa, 21% increase. 17% for East and Southern Africa, and 24% for Asia. This is from Reuters, March 4th, and from Malaysia. Under a new even-odd licensing scheme, even-numbered plates will only be allowed to drive on even dates and odd-numbered plates on odd dates, the announcement said. Electric vehicles and electric motorcycles are exempt. The NDSC warned businesses and individuals not to hoard fuel for resale at inflated prices, saying that violators would be prosecuted. This is from Nikkei, April 7th.
Katsuragi Onsen, a public bathhouse, or sento, in Japan's northern Aomori Prefecture, with more than 50 years of history, said last month it will close at the end of May after being hit by surging fuel costs. Specialty trading house GSI Krios said it will adjust production plans for paints and thinners used in plastic model kits, citing instability in raw material procurement. From this month, it will narrow production and focus on high-demand products.
Speaking of shortages, this is from the Times of Israel, yesterday, April 6th. I'm very upset. Trump says U.S. tried to arm Iranian protesters, but guns were diverted. In January, during the mass wave of anti-regime protests that swept across Iran, Trump had vowed that, quote, help was on the way, and urged protesters to take to the streets and seize institutions. But after the regime began its crackdown, reportedly killing tens of thousands, Trump backed down. And when we're seeing anything, this is my editorializing here, we're seeing anything. It seems like the bottom is 30,000. I'm seeing 40, 50, 60, 70,000. Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time believing that the Iranian government killed more people than were killed, an equal number. Or I find it fascinating that the number that many sources refer to, like 60,000, 70,000, is like the number of dead that the Gaza Health Ministry says that were killed in the Israeli siege on Gaza. And it's, you know, over a weekend.
Yeah.
It just beggars belief. After regime began its crackdown, reportedly killing tens of thousands, Trump backed down, only beginning military operations against Iran weeks later alongside Israel. We sent guns, a lot of guns. They were supposed to go to the people so they could fight back against these thugs, Trump told reporters. You know what happened? The people that they sent them to kept them, Trump went on. They said, what a beautiful gun, I think I'll keep it, Trump claimed, adding, so I'm very upset with a certain group of people and they're going to pay a big price for that. Now, he had made mention a day prior to giving this quote, which I believe he gave on Easter, that saying that the Kurds were given guns and that they kept them. We collating that with the report that came out today in the New York Times, the Maggie Haberman, Jonathan Swan thing. It seems like the entire Kurdish invasion thing was sort of something that the Israelis kind of just made up was going to happen. In order for Trump to believe that there was this multifaceted plan that was going to go down there. It looks less and less likely to occur every day. Who knows, though? Everything keeps you guessing. Financial Times, March 30th.
Israel's parliament has passed a controversial bill that seeks to impose the death penalty on Palestinians convicted of killing Israelis in acts of terror, but not on Jewish Israelis who kill Palestinians in similar circumstances.
The bill passed in the Knesset 62-48. What a word I hate saying, Knesset. Good God. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, that's how you say it.
Knesset.
Yeah.
We don't love that.
No.
The Knu.
Like a Knish.
It's the Knesset.
Yeah.
To me. But the Knesset, 62-48. Netanyahu, of course, voted in favor of it. Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister of Israel, has been wearing a noose pin on his lapel, campaigning for it. He is, of course, a member of the Jewish Power Party and formerly a member of the Kash Party, started by Meir Kahn. Meir Kahn started the JDL in 1968, and this, from the New York Times, March 27th, man tied to pro-Israel extremist accused of targeting Palestinian activist.
Members of the FBI and the police department's Joint Terrorism Task Force notified the activist, Nerdine Kiswani, and her lawyer late Thursday that an arrest had been made in connection with an imminent attempt on her life, her lawyer and law enforcement officials said. The man who was arrested, Alexander Heffler, 26, of Hoboken, New Jersey, was taken into custody after detectives and federal agents searched his apartment and found 8 Molotov cocktails. A police official said Friday that Mr. Heffler was a member of the JDL 613 Brotherhood, which was inspired by the Jewish Defense League, a pro-Israel group designated by the FBI as a terrorist organization. Representatives of the JDL and its offshoot did not immediately reply to messages seeking comment.
Further in the article, it says that he was planning on fleeing to Israel after he had firebombed Nardine and, I believe, her husband and baby. So JDL 613's website has a very interesting section on our president, Yisrael Jacob Ben Avraham. And I don't know if I can do the voice for this, and you'll see why. Yisrael Jacob Ben Avraham, the founder and president of the JDL 613 Brotherhood, embodies the resilience, faith, and fierce commitment to Jewish pride and defense that define our organization. Raised in Central Jersey in a proud, hardworking Catholic family, Yisrael grappled with spiritual disconnection. Things just don't sit right with me, he recalls. I believed in a higher power, a creator, but I felt lost, with a hole in my heart and soul. Searching for meaning, Yisrael battled drug addiction for over 2 decades, chasing fleeting distractions to fill that void. Despite years of trying to get clean through rehab, medication, and therapy, nothing eased the pain or silenced the urge to escape. I'll cut in here.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the Catholic part in a moment, but I just wanted to mention that. Let's be real. If it's been 2 decades, time's up. The drugs won. Just be like, I'm just going to do drugs for the rest of my life. A near-fatal overdose became a turning point. Collapsing alone at home for 17 hours, Yisrael awoke unable to move his legs. Dragging himself to a phone to call 911, he faced 8 grueling months in the hospital enduring dialysis, major surgery to remove dead muscle in his calf, and the threat of losing his leg. What's the fucking Street Hassle music starts playing here? For two years, he relied on a wheelchair, but through sheer determination and a little bit of internal ableism, he relearned to walk, now moving forward without a cane. During this transformative period, Yisrael discovered Judaism. Embracing its teachings, he immersed himself in the Jewish community, which welcomed him with open arms, never judging him for his past nor his status as a convert. The Jewish community has always accepted me for who I am, Yisrael says, never putting me down or treating me differently because of my background. Through deep faith, Torah study, and a profound relationship with Hashem, Yisrael achieved what years of programs could not. He overcame his addiction without rehab or external aid, relying solely on his spiritual awakening. Completing his conversion with the Beit Din and Mikvah just 2 weeks before October 7th, 2023, Yisrael faced a new reality as anti-Semitic incidents surged 344% in the U.S. with 9,354 attacks in 2024 alone.
You know, this makes me think, I don't feel like I hear too much about, like, Jewish 12-step programs. Maybe you know better than I. Do these exist?
There's a lot of I'm going to be honest. Yeah. I did not meet a Jewish person who believed in God in any appreciable way until I was well into adulthood.
Yeah, that's fair.
And to this day, I don't know if I know really. I know, like, 2 people who are practicing. And so within AA, not that I've been, but just from what I understand, no, I don't. I mean, I'm sure that there is, but never that I've encountered.
Because a lot of those Orthodox, they do, they party.
They drink.
Yeah.
But you don't see, there are Orthodox people in the program. One thing you never really see, the Chinese.
Okay.
You don't see the Chinese so much in there.
Because why is that?
It's bedeviled me for many years. You know, obviously I've lived in 2-3 great cities with large Chinese populations. You don't really see a lot of Chinese guys in there. Huh. What they do with them, I don't know. Because if you're a 55-year-old Chinese guy and you're like, I'm sick of having the most awesome life ever, which is where I get drunk and gamble with my friends in these community association halls every night.
Yeah.
It's fucking so sick. Uh-huh. And every time I would walk by them in San Francisco and the doors open, there's like 15 guys fucking all in their 60s, drinking beer, playing cards, smoking cigarettes. I'm like, God, I would love to walk in there, but they would never accept me. If they did walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sure people would accept them, but I don't know. They just do something with them.
Yeah.
And you don't see so much the Mexican or Spanish-speaking, they got their own ones.
Okay.
They have like their own separate, not separate, but like they got their own, like it's like Spanish language halls everywhere.
Right.
But with the Orthodox Jews, I don't know. Because, you know, you go to a Williamsburg one, not that I've been, again, and it's kind of just like bisexuals.
Uh-huh.
You know, not saying that a lot of these Orthodox guys are bisexual too, even if they don't admit it to themselves. But God knows where they go.
Yeah.
And God knows what the collection basket looks like in the meeting too. Passing the hat. Because that's usually sort of what you do. You pass a literal hat and God knows.
Well, it's a big hat ones. To fill.
I know. It's like $2,000 hats.
Yeah.
No, those guys also love doing Molly and shit. But this is extraordinary. And this isn't the guy that was planning to kill Nordine. Obviously, the guy belonged to his organization.
Right.
A Catholic convert in less than 2 years is running a organization, the JDL. It's an offshoot of the JDL that seems to be, I mean, Avraham here, I'm glad he turned his life around, but there's one of their members, I subscribe to their Telegram, and one of their members who posts a lot of videos of himself is... without the beyond the shadow of a doubt, no shadow of a doubt, there's no doubt, no shadows here whatsoever, a active tweaker.
Okay.
Maybe 3 teeth in his mouth, and I can tell, and this may sound prejudiced to some, but I say it with no avarice, no prejudice, no nothing, no judgment, a little bit of judgment. I can tell if you are or have ever been a tweaker.
Right.
Because it gets in your voice. Mm. It gets in your voice.
What's it sound like?
Yeah. You want to hear what it sounds like?
Yeah.
I'm going to play you. Let's play a selection of this guy's voice.
Okay.
Welcome to the Soft Fiend Podcast, the unapologetic voice of Jewish warriors, brought to you by the fierce defenders of the JDL 613, where we live by the 613 mitzvot and strike back against our enemies without mercy.
I'm baffled by that accent.
That is a tweaker voice, but sprinkled and spiced with a little bit of junkie in there.
Huh. Where's that guy from?
I believe he's from here.
Weird.
JDL 613 Brotherhood, I believe, is a tri-state area organization.
Take that one back to the
lab. I think that guy, or maybe Avraham, is a former Proud Boy as well.
I mean, there's a lot of telling on himself, I think, in these few paragraphs. I don't know how to begin to unpack it. I mean, it kind of unpacks itself, but it's like maybe he had more damage than just to his legs in this near-death experience.
I'm just going to say this. Catholic, ran far from the faith, became a drug addict, and is crazy in this certain way. We need to do some step work here, maybe. You were molested. And you got to come to terms with that. But here's the deal. You're talking about these anti-Semitic incidents that surged 344%.
Mm-hmm.
This ADL statistic. Is it possible for me to be anti-Semitic to you?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think that it is. I think I could walk out right up to this guy. I don't even... Actually, you know what? I think if I walked right up to this guy and said, "You, sir, are a cuck," I think that it would be an insult maybe to other Jewish people.
Yeah.
But to him, is it really? Because he's what are you?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It is a little, to me, I think, again, no analysis needed, you know? The facts speak for themselves there.
Yeah. Maybe when he was in that hospital, they had to they infused him with Jewish blood or something. And now it's like fighting a war with the junkie blood and the Catholic blood in his body, so.
That is a good point. Bill Wilson famously had this experience, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, had this experience where he saw a white light while he was in the hospital bed. But he was undergoing the Belladonna treatment.
Mm.
God knows what this guy saw, or was taking rather, in order to see the Jewish God, in order for Hashem to come down there and say, "We need you!
Yeah.
We need you so badly!" Perhaps he was given an Oxycontin 80.
Mm.
Although, I guess if you're for drug rehabilitation, maybe they wouldn't give
you that. Probably not.
They gave me Ativan, though.
Nice.
I know. It's fantastic. And they give it to a lot of drunks, too. Because if you're a big drinker, you go into you have seizures.
Yeah.
When you get people think that heroin's bad for you. Heroin's not that bad for you physically. It's this other stuff that's bad for you.
Yeah.
Alcohol is really bad for you, and so is benzos. And they work in your body similarly. So if you go into treatment and you're addicted to benzos, you're addicted to alcohol, they'll give you a little bit of benzo, take the edge off for a few days so you don't have a seizure. Because I've seen that happen. It's no good. No. No bueno. This is from the New York Times, 1971.
Dylan's interest in Israel and Judaism led him, over a year ago, into an unexpected relationship with Rabbi Meir Kahn and the Jewish Defense League. He has reportedly attended several meetings of the JDL and is rumored to have donated money to the organization. Rabbi Kahn will only say that Dylan has come around a couple of times to see what we're all about.
And speaking of Bob Dylan, who, of course, that selection is about, I don't know if you saw this, but he posted on Instagram that his new Patreon, Lectures from the Grave, The Dead Speak, starting today, exclusive on Patreon, $5 a month, featuring lectures from The Last Testament of Frank James, Aaron Burr on The Art of Survival, and something that I cannot read, The Life and Death of Wild Bill. Letters never sent from Poe to Valentino, etc. Original short stories. Patreon.com/BobDylan180.
I like that he has digits in his Patreon name. But our listeners can look out soon for some collab posts that
hopefully
we've got lined up with.
It appears
Mr.
to me, and I've seen people post, I've seen these Dylan fans post excerpts from some of the writing here and say, oh no, it's not AI generated. First of all, you don't know.
Yeah.
Second of all, it says it's curated by Bob Dylan, so obviously it is AI generated.
Yeah.
And second of all, you want to see what? Listen, I'm a giant Bobby fan.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you know this, but I have a huge Bob Dylan bootleg collection.
I don't know that you've talked about this much.
They call me the Little White Wonder.
Do they?
No, but they would if they knew about
yeah.
me. And the guy's been lousy for longer than I've been alive.
Yeah.
And I think about this with some of these old rockers sometimes. He's not really a rocker, but, you know, he's rocked once or twice. And it's like, God, you put out some amazing records. And then for decades and decades and decades, you put out just bad records.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, at what point do things overshadow the others? But we don't know. And maybe I'll get into later Bob Dylan at some point. Neighborhood Bully, that's me. Operation Epic Fury started February 28th. On that same day, the United States bombed the Menab Girls School, killing 160 young girls and teachers. This is from NBC News.
NBC News got a quote from a first responder named Jafar Kasemi. Most of them were children. No one spoke at first. It was like being in a silent film. Even a child sitting by the school wall whose face was completely burned, he said, adding, for me, time was moving very slowly. My feeling is a mix of anger about this attack and a strong determination to defend ourselves, he said. This war is a test of honor and the defense of human dignity. Every drop of blood spilled in this path will make the spirit of resistance stronger.
Do you recall that in the days after this strike, when asked about it, Donald Trump would say, oh, that was one of their missiles.
Right.
And this entire propaganda apparatus, all these Israeli propagandists, all these American ones, came out and said, no, it was the IRGC did this.
It's the same playbook they run every time. And every time we act like it's new and novel and has to be examined.
It is just, exactly. I mean, there's no analysis to be had here. They lie all the time, and they lie about everything. And then they blew this girl's school up. That's a cost of doing business. What is the business? For some reason, that is the U.S. and Israel overthrowing the government of Iran and plunging the country into chaos. According to the Energy Information Agency of the U.S. government, the average price of a gallon of gasoline in Los Angeles was $4 in January, $4.30 in February, $5.27 in March. Now, I was just in Los Angeles. Everyone I know there who worked in the entertainment industry cannot get a job for the life of them. It is over and done. This is from the Wall Street Journal.
The production slowdown has been especially acute for behind-the-scenes craftspeople who make up the bulk of the entertainment industry's middle class. Last year, they worked 36% fewer hours than in 2022, according to the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, the union that represents most of them. IATSE members must work a certain number of hours to qualify for health insurance coverage.
Who will make the beautiful movie about those brave pilots who, weeks after the United States had, according to our drunken Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, established total dominance over the skies of Iran, were shot down the other day? And in his Easter analogy, he said, oh, they were shot down on a Friday. I don't know what they did on a Saturday. And then they were rescued on a Sunday, which is, frankly, much like Jesus Christ himself. We don't know what he was doing in there.
Yeah.
But we say, we beg, oh, Chris Pratt, please make us a movie. It's the guy, Chris Pratt, right?
You got your Chris Pratt, you got your John Krasinski.
And there's a few of these other ones, too. I can't remember the name. Statham.
Jason Statham?
Yeah. Doesn't he make a lot of war movies?
Yeah, but he's British. I don't think of him as the same as those.
It's not his business.
He makes Crank.
He's to Keir Starmer, he says, I'm not getting involved in this one.
He's the beekeeper.
I'm not getting involved in this one, mate.
Yeah.
I'll stay out of it.
Yeah, that's good. That's Jason Statham.
Those pilots, obviously, like all members of the United States Air Force, are irredeemable drug addicts. No, you laugh, but it's true. They all take modafinil.
Yeah.
And I was reminded by about a tweet from my favorite, this guy, Gary Tan, who I love.
Yeah.
I love this guy, Gary Tan. Gary with two R's, as if you could make him not. God said this, Brace, I want you to love this man with all your heart. And I said, I can do that. And he said, actually, I need you to love him with the strength of two hearts. And I said, I don't know how. How can I do that?
Mm.
And he said, I'm going to give him another fucking R in his name. Gary Tan.
Yeah.
There's two R's in there.
Well, he made that famous Half-Life mod that everybody loves.
What's that?
Gary's mod.
Did he actually?
No, but it's also spelled with two R's,
oh,
which is weird.
Good God. He said, I took modafinil just to stay awake longer to be able to turn the momentary crystalline structures I had in my brain into lines of code before sleep or human distraction turned it to grains of sand. I love coding, but I love coding with AI even more. I speak, it listens, and we create. I see the structure, and it is built. There is no more powerful an experience to me than that.
I have to interject for a moment. As I write code, and I like writing code, and so on some sense, you know, on some level, I'm like, I guess I get what you mean. But like the way that these guys talk about loving writing code is just the most pathetic, because they don't know how to express themselves. And it's so fucking embarrassing. It makes me squirm. And maybe I'm saying this to defend the beauty of writing good code, but just the way they talk about it is so fucking lame and stupid. And he's trying to make it sound cool and poetic and just has no ability to do that.
He is about 4'10".
Yeah.
And I mean, something will happen to him eventually. Not by my hand or anyone's hand. God, obviously.
He needs to lose one of those R's.
He needs, and we'll just continue because anything I say, and this is a non-analytic podcast, just the facts here. April 6, 2026, the Moscow Times, Ukrainian drones attacked the Caspian Pipeline Consortium's marine terminal in southern Russia early Monday, damaging part of a mooring plant and setting four oil tanks ablaze, Russia's defense ministry said. The Ukrainian army said it had attacked a different terminal in the port of Novorossiysk, without mentioning the Caspian Pipeline Consortium. The CPC pipeline, which had not commented, handles around 1% of the world's oil supplies, as well as around 80% of Kazakhstan's exports. During the night, Ukraine, quote, attacked facilities at the marine transshipment complex in Novorossiysk using fixed-wing attack drones, the Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement on Telegram. Now, this is back to me speaking here. That may not sound like anything spectacular to you. The Ukrainian army has proven themselves quite capable of operations within Russia using drones. This is pretty, they're attacking farther and farther, and the capabilities have grown more and more. And their ability to attack Russia, sort of notwithstanding, I think for the future of war, we're thinking about here. I think oftentimes we think of this drone stuff as either, you know, predators high up, this, you know, these higher altitude craft that function almost like, you know, regular Air Force. You know, they kind of go around and they shoot down and they can be shot down. And this is sort of an intermediate thing, right? These are sort of long range, almost not FPV drones, but likened to that, suicide drones.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing this with the Shahed drones in Iran too. And I think a lot of people are like, well, when is drone warfare really going to like get going? And it is going. It is going and it's happening. And it, I think it is going to change the world in a major way.
For the better?
I think it's just going to change the world in a major way. Yeah. This is from Technology Magazine. Actually, I don't even have a quote here. I'm just going to, but it's, I read this in Technology Magazine, which there's no way that's a real magazine. Mm.
I think the magazine's called like Information.
I know, but I think that they're logic. Just press release chops. From April 6th. They say Metroblox is a company that builds and operates future-led urban data centers that cater towards AI and sustainability. And that the company was founded, Metroblox, in January of 2024, not too long ago. This is from Metroblox website from April 6th.
Metroblox is developing a state-of-the-art high-density data center in Indianapolis, engineered for scalability and power densities of 150 kilowatts plus per rack. Built to Uptime Institute Tier 3 standards, the facility supports diverse workloads ranging from general computing to AI/ML. Flexible hybrid cooling solutions, air and direct-to-chip liquid, ensure efficiency and adaptability for next-generation demands. Strategically located near the FDIX Internet Exchange Point, the site delivers exceptional connectivity with low-latency access to 42 million people within 20 milliseconds, including major metros such as Chicago, Toronto, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh. Indianapolis is emerging as a cost-effective Midwest data center hub, driven by industry-leading tax incentives and competitive power pricing.
So what they're saying there is that they're building a data center, Metroblox is, in Indianapolis. And specifically, that data center is being built in the Martindale-Brightwood neighborhood. That neighborhood, I looked it up, is 78% black with a median income of $32,000 a year. Wow. It contains a Superfund site where the former American lead factory building was. The lead contaminated the surrounding area. It is in the soil. Cleanup continued into 2025. In fact, this is an EPA Region 5 report from 2017 that I read on the plane yesterday. A review of historical city directories showed that in 1960, Martindale Brightwood had 147 sites that could, quote, reasonably be classified as environmental hazards, end quote, including foundries, tool and die makers, and plating operations. This is from the Indiana Economic Digest from last year.
From 2000 to 2009, the Marion County Public Health Department collected thousands of blood samples from residents of Indianapolis citywide and from residents in the Martindale-Brightwood area. The findings showed blood lead levels were 2 to 4 times higher in children living in Martindale-Brightwood than in children in the rest of the city.
And actually, I don't have them here. I don't know why. I guess I forgot to put them in. But the other statistics about the neighborhood are fucking horrible. Heart disease through the fucking roof, cancer, diabetes, all of these significantly higher than the rest of Indianapolis. But the residents of Martindale Brightwood should be grateful. These data centers could one day help the U.S. military target another school in another country, much like Iran. However, when this data center was announced, huge protests erupted across the neighborhood. They did not succeed. This is from April 1st, Mirror Indy, and the headline says, Metroblox $500 million data center okayed despite public outcry.
The Metropolitan Development Commission approved the $500 million, nearly 14-acre project after a 6-2 vote at its April 1st meeting. Board members asked questions during the roughly two-hour meeting, but did not explain their votes.
This is from the New York Times from yesterday.
Shots fired at Indianapolis councilman's home after a vote-backing data center. Bullets hit the home of an Indianapolis city councilman early Monday morning, leaving shattered glass and holes throughout the front door, and a handwritten note reading, "No data centers," was left under the doormat. The councilman, Ron Gibson, was among the city's leaders who voted 6-2 last week to approve a rezoning measure that would allow Metroblox, a Los Angeles company, to build a data center on the northeast side of Indianapolis. Local residents had protested the proposed data center for months, citing concerns about environmental impacts and changes to a historic neighborhood, according to reporting by WTHR-TV of Indianapolis.
Speaking of AI, I want to look at some pictures from Instagram. This is from a woman I follow, a pair of women I follow, named Pamela Taylor. To describe this, it is a well-built woman in a pink dress, sort of a prom-style dress, with her arm on her hip, and coming from a tasteful rack of breasts, a little above that, whatever, the chest, I believe it's called, erupting from that are two stalks of neck, and on each of those necks is an identical head. We are looking at a sexy conjoined twin.
It's like Zaphod Beeblebrox style.
What's that?
You never read Hitchhiker's Guide?
Yes, I did.
Well,
I don't, was that?
That was the guy with the two heads.
I read that in like
okay. Well, I'm sure our nerdy listeners will picture it.
And he had two heads?
Yeah, that was his main.
Well, her Instagram caption, could you read this?
The caption is, "Does this dress look good on us?"
I want you to read the fucking emoji.
Oh, with a pink bow emoji?
Yes. And these are a selection of comments. And I looked at, by the way, I looked at all of her pictures. I've been following her for a while. And with stuff like this, you got to imagine that many of the comments are themselves AI or bots. And so I click on people's profiles to see if they are or not. These are from real people.
Richard Matthews Jr. comments, "You are a lucky girl. Not all we man are equal." Swirly heart emoji. Presumably he meant not all women are equal.
No.
Harry 061951 says, "I suspect AI. However, the thought of making out to Tian," presumably he means twin, "beauties brings warmth below." And Darren Robert Broadhage comments, "Beautiful ladies," heart emoji, fire emoji.
I click on Darren Robert Broadhage's profile, and what do I see? A picture of an older man in his early 60s wearing a Trump t-shirt, a Trump hat, says Trump, save America, and holding up a sign that says, "Don't blame me, I voted for Trump."
But because it's the selfie cam, it's backwards.
Yes. And this is what these people are like. It's just, we are in, there is a, you think of how these things happen, right? You see a picture of a bridge that's cleaved in two. You hear reports or you read reports about a double tap strike against the first responders who show up. You read about the girls' school. You read about the price of, you know, fertilizer skyrocketing in India. You read about all these things. And then you say, God, why is all this stuff happening? Like, why is the world just getting worse and worse and worse and worse? And you decide, okay, I'm going to let off some steam. I'm going to look at this AI-generated two-headed woman that I follow on Instagram. And then you click on one of the guys who's saying, "Beautiful ladies," heart emoji, fire. And he's like, "You know what? All that shit that's going down right now, it's going down because I love it. I love it." New York Times obituaries, March 25th.
Leonid Ridvinsky, an innovative purveyor of online pornography who turned a tiny website called OnlyFans into an adult entertainment powerhouse, redefining the industry for the social media era, has died. He was 43. OnlyFans announced his death from cancer in a statement on Monday. It did not specify when or where he died. He lived in Florida.
God, this was a real blow to me.
Mm-hmm.
So OnlyFans itself, I don't know if you know this, was actually started by a father and son in England as a website. I believe originally it was like to interact with celebrities. It was like a sort of cameo kind of thing.
Yeah.
Radvinsky bought it in 2018 and turned it into a porn website. This is from a 2021 Forbes article about his previous websites. Looking through the Wayback Machine's website archive, Forbes uncovered 11 such sites, we'll get to that, all created in the late 1990s or early 2000s by Radvinsky and his Glenview, Illinois-based business, Cybertania. They included Password Universe, which, in 2000, published a link directing web users to a site claiming to offer pedophiles more than 10,000, quote, illegal preteen passwords.
What does that mean?
God knows. In 1999, a site called Working Passes had a link for, quote, the hottest underage hardcore containing 16-year-olds. Also in 2000, another site, Ultra Passwords, promised a link containing the best illegal teen passwords and the hottest bestiality site on the web. The legal age for porn actors in the U.S. is 18, while bestiality, the act of having sex with an animal, is illegal in most American sites.
I guess this whole passwords thing is just, I'm not familiar with it, but it seems to be a theme.
And there are people making amounts of money that you could never even dream of off of this. And, you know, if it for those who were about to cancel my $10,000 a month in subscription on OnlyFans, I can't give another cent to this guy. Do not worry. Apparently, these seem to have been scam websites that sort of endlessly looped and were basically ways to trick, I don't know, other porn websites into getting ad revenue. I don't know if I'll necessarily take Forbes' word for that because he had something like, he had registered something like 10,000 websites. I'm like, well, certainly something had to have something on it. And he was obviously quite close to the pornography business. This is from Lever News. From February 1st, 2024, inside the Israel lobby's new $90 million war chest. According to the internal documents, Radvinsky and his wife, Katie Chudnovsky, pledged 11... let me take his last name, please! According to the internal documents, Radvinsky and his wife, Katie Chudnovsky, pledged $11 million to AIPAC, the most of anyone listed. I didn't donate or pledge $11 million, Radvinsky wrote in an email, and this applies to me slash my foundation slash my family. When the Lever asked Radvinsky why AIPAC had him listed as a donor, Radvinsky replied, I don't know. When the Lever asked Radvinsky to comment on internal AIPAC documentation showing a wire transfer from his wife to AIPAC, Radvinsky stopped responding. This is from the Miami Herald, March 25th.
At Miami Forum, Delcy Rodriguez makes once unthinkable appeal for U.S. investment. Speaking to the FII Priority Forum, a global gathering in Miami Beach of more than 1,000 business leaders, policymakers, and investors, Rodriguez cast Venezuela as an economy in recovery and newly open to private capital, particularly in the energy sector. At the core of Rodriguez's pitch is Venezuela's vast energy potential and a newly enacted hydrocarbons law that expands the role of private investors. The legislation allows companies to participate directly in exploration, production, and commercialization, while introducing more flexible tax and royalty structures and allowing for international arbitration, provisions designed to ease long-standing concerns over legal uncertainty. Rodriguez said Venezuela holds the world's largest proven oil reserves, about 303 billion barrels, and production costs comparable to Saudi Arabia, among the lowest globally. She added that the new framework allows investors to negotiate terms on up to 64% of a barrel's value, including reductions in royalties and income taxes, a level of flexibility rarely seen under previous state-dominated models.
Other speakers at the conference were Donald Trump Jr., Witkoff, the heads of Meta, Barclays, dozens more, and of course, Aramco. Some of Saudi Aramco's facilities were hit by Iranian, I believe, drones within the past few weeks. And then you go over to TMZ on April 3rd, and you read this. Check out my 350-carat post-prison bling. It's about Tekashi 6ix9ine. It says, Tekashi collaborated with Vobara Miami for this one-of-a-kind piece, which is titled The Apex Redemption, The Return of 6ix9ine, and features pendants that represent some of his tattoos he had before he went back to the slammer. The flowers total 165 carats of round, emerald, and marquise-cut diamonds, plus colored sapphires and black diamonds. The stunning lion pendant is 186 carats, completed with round, emerald, baguette, and fancy-cut diamonds. The piece weighs more than 4 pounds, we're told. So he actually posted an Instagram video of him receiving the necklace the moment he stepped out of jail. This is me talking now. He also reveals a figurine of SpongeBob that he apparently had while locked up. And he points to the signature of Nicolas Maduro. It says, Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela, forever. So listen, I know this has been an episode with a lot of reading. And maybe all of these things don't make sense next to each other. But for me, I've just been looking at the news, and it's just one thing after another, and you just go, okay, just moving on, okay, moving on, okay, moving on. And it feels, and I don't know if you get this sense, but it feels to me right now that something is building up to something. And I know that's quite vague, but that there is some kind of terrible resolution coming. And I don't know to who or to what or what it's going to look like. But, you know, I'm not one of these guys who these sort of, and you see this stuff online a lot. These slop guys are like, you need to panic. Yeah. You need to go crazy.
The everything next month, will change.
Everything is going to go fucking crazy. The reality is, if you're an American, I don't know if you do. You know, you might have to. Maybe your vacation will get a little expensive. But there's these ripple effects that are being felt from what's going on right now. All over everywhere. Not everything we're talking about is part of these ripple effects. Although, actually, let me rephrase that. Let me just recant it entirely. No edit necessary. Because, okay, while Radvinsky's untimely death from cancer at 43 might not directly have something to do with the attack on Iran that Trump and Israel made in February 28th and are continuing to make to this day. And in fact, now we're what, 3 hours away from deadline? It's all part of what is happening now. And what is happening now, and there's no word that I think can fully sum it up other than just society, I guess, is something that is sick and it is sickening. All of these things. Every second you turn on the fucking news or, God forbid, social media, every time you see anybody say anything about anything, it is always the most vile thing that you will ever hear in your life until you hear or read the next thing. We are becoming a society of just antisocial, of antisocial fucking monsters. And it is just all this stuff, as you just read it and you read it and you read it and you see these news stories, and then maybe you go outside and you go for a walk and nothing's happening out there, but all over the world, it's like these vibrations are felt. And that's the thing with the Strait of Hormuz closure, but even in general with the war in Iran and the destabilization of the Middle East. You know, there are first order effects of this. Okay, like, yeah, gas is more expensive in LA right now than it was 2 months ago. Urea is more expensive, although it's not at 2022 levels yet. But you know, things get more expensive than you know, like we talked about with the Japan stuff. Some company that makes specialized paints for models, they have to kind of cut back on their products there. Those are immediate effects. And then there's longer term effects. And actually, some of the longer term effects regarding oil can actually be a little bit mitigated. And supplies of certain goods and supply chains in certain ways can be somewhat mitigated by finding other suppliers in other countries, by changing routes that ships go. In South Korea, for instance, they are now like, listen, oil tankers, just do the Red Sea route. Even though it's also dangerous, just do that one because it's less dangerous. Yeah. And so these things can kind of be mitigated, or they can be you know, moved around, or they can be made up for in other ways. But then those things have other after order effects, and there's all these like cascading effects that these have. And for what? That's something that I've heard zero MAGA people grapple with in a real way. For what? The U.S. is not safer. The world, not that these people give a shit about that, is not safer. Things are harder for everybody all over the world, a little bit in the U.S. Oh, maybe you can't, maybe jet fuel prices are going to increase, you know, your fucking plane ticket costs so you can't go to the Amalfi Coast this summer or whatever. Or maybe you can, it's just more expensive. But all of these things, you know, you don't hear anything from the MAGA types except for, oh, well, it was going to happen eventually, or we trust him, or he knows what he's doing. Donald Trump does not know what he's doing. I think that is abundantly clear here. You can say, oh, he's even right now, again, 3 hours on the dot, it's 5 o'clock on the dot to the deadline. Oh, he's just bluffing. It's the art of the deal. Haven't you read The Art of the Deal? What are we getting out of the deal?
Yeah.
Iran doesn't have a missile program. I want Iran to have missiles. Hmm. The country that Iran shoots missiles at, Israel, is my enemy. If I tried to go to Iran 3 months ago, they would probably let me in. If I tried to go to Israel 3 months ago, I would probably get turned away at the border. It's It beggars belief that somebody would think that the U.S. is like the good guys in this war. And you see this really half-hearted from some people. Oh, well, I don't like Trump, but, you know, taking out these mullahs, it's still a good thing, right? Says you? Says some fucking dumb fucking cocksucker in like either a Foundation for Defense of Democracy or whatever organization that is essentially exactly the same as FDD? Says whatever fucking unregistered FARA agent who works for fucking the Daily Wire? You know? I mean, it is just like, it is, I don't understand how much more of this people can take. And that is hyperbolic because actually people can take essentially an infinite amount of this. American people will eat shit like it is fucking the last thing on earth and they are hungry. It bothers me, and then I don't let it bother me, and then it bothers me again, and I don't let it bother me, because I do try to love everybody. I try to love each and every American. It is getting quite difficult. It is getting quite difficult. You know, it is... there's no refunds for these MAGA fucking idiots.
Yeah.
As they talk about cutting Medicare and Medicaid. So what, we can give some more fucking modafinil to some of these stupid fucking A-10 pilots so they can crash their fucking planes that we pay for? Why the fuck do we... It's tax time right now. I hate paying taxes. And fuck all you democratic socialists. We need people to pay taxes. Hell no. We need nobody to pay taxes. I don't want my taxes. Another fucking Tomahawk missile, please. Yeah. Give me a fucking break with this shit. I don't know. I get more and more frustrated. And I know I can be ham-handed. And I know that maybe I'm throwing everything here at the wall to see what sticks. But I really sometimes feel like I'm going a little nuts here because it doesn't seem like there is anybody who is adult enough and is serious enough to say, stop this. Like, you fucking mutant freaks, Steve Chung, fucking Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, all these malformed, mutated, ugly, and you can tell they smell like shit. All these people who are dragging this country to, and it is a country that has a lot of blood on its hands. But still, I live here, I'm from here. You know, it's a beautiful country. I don't want to see these people drag it down any further, but they are, and they're gonna. And they're gonna have the support of a lot of people while they do it. And whoever comes in after them isn't gonna fix it, but is just gonna do it, whatever the fucking, get back. What did Joe Biden do? Good God. These people will get us back to some measure of sanity. That cat is so far out of the bag that it might as well be wherever cats go. They go fuck other cats, right? They go to the alleyway and they fuck other cats and they eat fish bones. Do they eat the fish? That's the poor cats do that.
Yeah.
The rich cats have the whole fish. That's who makes the
bones. And they just toss the bones.
They just toss. Yeah, we don't even need this. You know, it is. Again, this episode has no analysis in it. It is just the facts here. And I'm still just speaking. These are purely facts. This is not my opinion at all. My opinion is greatly different than this, obviously. But I hate these people. I hate the government that they make up. And I hate the world that they're making. And it for so much of my life, hate was enough. You know? Anytime I really, really, you know, and I try to be judicious in my use of it, but I've hated a lot since I was born, and sometimes I've hated too much, and sometimes I've hated too little. But often when I've really needed it, hate has been enough to carry me over to whatever goal that I have here. There is not enough hate in me to make things right here. And it frankly, it doesn't seem like there's not enough hate in the American populace to really change things here. I just, it drives me crazy. I mean, how much more of this are people willing to put up with? How many more days or months or years are we willing to let the world's future, this country's future, your family's future be in the hands of these people who, you know, and I talk about my hatred. These people hate on a level that I could not even dream of. Because at least my hatred is tempered by great feelings of love. I do not think that Pete Hegseth has that same tempered, feeling that infects him. I think maybe he loves rape. Maybe he hates seeing a woman walk by him unraped. God knows. You know, Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, all these people, they are pieces of shit. They are irredeemable. They are crazy. And they are ruining the fucking world. And I am sick of it. Anyways, my name is Brace.
I'm producer Young Chomsky.
I'm Liz. And this has been True Non. We will see you next time. Bye-bye. Jeffrey Epstein.